And welcome back to Real Clear with Dr. Klein, the crossroads of politics and psychology. If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this next episode. Welcome back to Real Clear Podcast with Dr. Klein. It's the week of March 25th, 2024. I'd like to talk to you about some strange things happening in my field, as I'm off to do these days. You know, I've been on other shows to talk about various aspects of this. And today, what I'd like to do is offer you some stories with little commentary. Well, as little as I can muster, although it's going to be hard for me not to jump in and tell you what I think about it too much. I think these stories speak for themselves, however. Prior to my telling you these stories, I'm going to read to you a very impressive study coming out of Scandinavia in the Scandinavian Journal of Psychology. It's entitled, Construction and Validation of a Scale for Assessing Critical Social Justice Attitudes, and I'll cut through all the technical jargon for you and tell you the outcome. If you're on the left, or you possess critical social justice attitudes as defined in the study, you are more likely to be depressed, anxious, and miserable. And women expressed more than twice as much support for the propositions of critical social justice as men. These are all things we know intuitively, but it's nice to have empirical data for it. And yes, I know, if you did a study on far-right ideology, you'd find pathology there, likely clustering around paranoid personality. But that's a story for another time. The far-right also is not gaining a foothold in the psychology profession, which makes it irrelevant right now. Okay. I'm going to tell you a bunch of stories, and I'd like to hear your reactions. If you remember, go to realclearpodcast.com and comment on the post. The first story that I'd like to talk about, and this is going to require a bit more commentary than the rest of them, from the Wall Street Journal. I always knew I was different. I just didn't know I was a sociopath. I want to be open about my experiences because I know I'm not alone. This woman claims to have a doctorate in psychology, though she doesn't call herself a psychologist, interestingly enough, and claims that she has spent many, many years just feeling different, and describes her experience of being a sociopath, as she claims she is, as basically being kind of autistic-like, like it's some sort of neurodivergence that she's suffering with. And, of course, as is the case with so many in our society these days, she looks for a way to reframe everything into oppression. At the end, she tells us, after years of study, intensive therapy, and earning a PhD in psychology, I can say that sociopaths aren't bad, or evil, or crazy. We simply have a harder time with feelings. That's right, a harder time. We act out to fill a void. When I understood this about myself, I was able to control it. It is a tragic misconception that all sociopaths are doomed to hopeless, loveless lives. The truth is that I share a personality type with millions of others, many of whom have good jobs, close-knit families, and real friends. We represent a truth that's hard to believe. There's nothing inherently immoral about having limited access to emotion. I offer my story because I know I'm not alone. Okay. Patrice Gagné is a writer, former therapist, and advocate for people suffering from sociopathic, psychopathic, and antisocial personality disorders. This essay is adapted from her book, Sociopath, a Memoir, which will be available in April by Simon & Schuster. Where do I begin? This is going to require some commentary. The rest of the stories, I think, speak for themselves, but this one requires me to jump in. It is not immoral, this author claims, to have a sociopathic personality. It is not immoral. My dear, antisocial personality is defined by moral trespasses on other people. My dear, sociopaths are defined by their ethical and immoral effect on others. My dear, antisocial personality disorder is defined by criminality, by trespasses on authority, by problems with boundaries, and caring about other people at all. My dear, antisocial personality disorders make up the vast majority of people in prison. You can hear me banging on this table. This is a person who, if she has this condition, I'm not even going to call it that in reality, if she has this label, this diagnosis, doesn't seem to understand it. Moreover, if she actually is a sociopath, why should we believe that her writing this story is anything other than an attempt to sell a book? Because a sociopath, by definition, would just try to peddle empathy concoctions for the purposes of secondary gain. She describes her journey through life in basically an autistic manner, as if sociopathy is just some sort of newest neurodivergence that is oppressed by the normals in life. We can't treat personality disorders anymore, by the way, in the therapy field writ large, because we refuse to take a moral standpoint on other people. And you cannot treat personality disorders, especially narcissism and borderline, without focusing on the immoral and ethical effects they have on those around them. The treatment cannot occur. And in terms of treatment for sociopaths, my dear, that's not been done successfully before. Never, ever, ever. So you'd be the first. Okay, moving on. So there is an institute in Los Angeles that I used to have an interest in, but it's, well, gone into a tailspin like so many others. Here is a talk given by the Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis this year. Decolonizing Psychoanalytic Technique, From Repressed Histories to Pragmatic Realities. This presentation will review the oft-ignored history of decolonial thinking among Global South psychoanalysts going back to the inception of the field, and derive from it a series of clinical principles for psychotherapeutic practice today. These principles read through the work of revolutionary psychiatrist Franz Fanon, help us to connect therapeutic action to political action, off the couch and in the streets. This is what our psychoanalysts are doing today, at least in the intersubjective and relational fields. Franz Fanon, by the way, was an avowed communist, a very influential Marxist in South America. And this is what's percolating through our fields. I'm going to move on to something that I maybe should have led with. This is coming from Division 39 of the APA, that is the Psychoanalytic Division of the American Psychological Association. This talk is entitled, Inhabiting the Systems We Create, Creating the Symptoms We Treat. This actually comes with credit hours for continuing education for psychologists, as the previous one did, by the way. And the presenters aim to create a space in which community can think together about the way that the clinic necessarily must and does expand into our outer, outside the clinic boundaries, conditions, contingencies, / worlds. That is, they will address the ways in which socio-historical political materials, realities, are inseparable from the work we do clinically and also from dyadic engagements across various domains in our lives. In doing this, they will share their process not only as clinicians, but as human beings engaged in psychodynamic ways across friendships, as patients in therapy, in work settings, in community, and in family. Both will dedicate this platform to inviting participants to think about the psychodynamics of organizing, specifically around Palestinian liberation, the relationship between organizing and clinical work, and the relationship between subjectivity, symptoms, clinical work, and political positionality. Learning objectives for all you learners out there. At the end of this program, you'll be able to think about the relationship between socio-historical political conditions and clinical work. You will be able to apply your own lived experience, your positionality, to your clinical work. And you'll be able to reflect on the kinds of relational, interpersonal work and therapeutics done within the context of political organizing. Now, let me take you through the presenters, and I'm going to read their own descriptions. A white, queer, non-Zionist, Jewish, Buddhist clinician working and living on Abenaki land in New Hampshire. Oh, I can hardly do this. This is an individual, graduated from the School for Social Work, blah, 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 blah. They currently work as a clinician at a boarding high school, oh good, treating kids, as well as holding a small private practice for adults and couples. Oh, good, treating the public. Their professional interests include queer and trans feminist theory. I'm shocked. The inseparability of politics and intrapsychic and relational dynamics, and the co-facilitation of spaces for community building and solidarity. They have published 3 peer-reviewed articles. One was White Clinical Dyads, another, Gender Play in Clinical Work, and the third, Anti-Racism in Psychoanalytic Institutions. And of course, they're committed to social justice and psychoanalysis and talking about how psychoanalytic discourses and practice should remain dedicated to, blah, blah, blah. Okay, the other person presenting is a writer, poet, and clinical social worker currently based in Brooklyn, New York, Lenape Land, he calls it. He is a graduate of blah, 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 and has the same bona fides. These are the therapists in the world that are emerging and taking over the field. Honestly, I just wanted to let you know what is out there. Okay? Moving on. This is a workshop that was sent to me from a friend. Sex with Animals, Clinical and Philosophical and... I'm sorry. Sex with Animals, Clinical and Philosophical Engagement with Zoophilia. Quote, products of conception, abortion, femtech, and fetal fetish. 1.75 continuing education hours for therapists. Quote, this panel centers psychoanalytic theory and practice as unique spaces to interrogate the weaponization of not just desire, but sex by criminalizing pregnancy and abortion. We contend the fetish functions of the fetus and surveillance over gestating bodies operates as a defensive strategy to disavow realities and responsibilities of climate crisis and other threats to cisgender, heteropatriarchal, and white settler colonial futures. This panel details ways in which technologies are being deployed to influence the behaviors of bodies with uteruses and render them subject to criminal charges. Clinical examples will illustrate the importance of psychoanalysis to restrict and fight these attacks. Again, folks, I just wanted to let you know what's out there. I'm not going to put commentary on that. But if you were looking for a talk on sex with animals, you know where to find I can hardly do this. But you know where to find it. Okay, in Britain, there is a funded project, much like the Holmes Report in American Psychoanalysis, that has just made way, decolonizing the curriculum of group analysis. This project arose out of discussions and work done within the curriculum subgroup of the Institute of Group Analysis, Power, Privilege, and Position Working Group. This decolonizing group analysis is not about group analysis analyzing colonialism, but about group analysis acknowledging that it is implicated in colonial dynamics and thus addressing colonial dynamics in group analysis. They are interested in reading study materials and assessments that are inclusive of global South perspectives, in other words, Marxism, and emancipatory conceptual frameworks such as black feminism, decolonial, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, queer, and critical race theories are only a fundamental starting point. It could go anywhere from there. The growth is literally infinite. They also funded another study on the discrimination and othering within the field of intergroup dynamics. And the last story of the evening is the Freud Museum hosts controversial pro-Palestine campaigner at communist mental health event. And this is published in the Telegraph, UK. Okay, the Freud Museum has been criticized for hosting a communist mental health event for controversial pro-Palestine campaigner. And oh, is she? This is put on by the Red Clinic. The Red Clinic somehow has taken over the Freud Museum. And the event includes an academic, in quotes, I'll put that, Lara Shiai, who now teaches at Qatar after leaving a U.S. university following student complaints and an investigation into unproven allegations of anti-Semitism in her class. She is a trans-inclusive feminist and liberation theory follower and has described the October 7th Hamas brutal attacks on Israel as horrifying liberation. And she will be giving a talk at the home of Sigmund Freud's honorable practice. Well, I thought I was going to get through all that without being snarky, but I knew right from the beginning that there was no way that my sarcasm was not going to ram right through my reporting these stories to you. Anyways, that's what's out there